Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Char. On this week's podcast, what role does the sun have in creating climate change on Earth?
I would have said that at most, the sun could be contributing about a third of modern warming. However, this week I learnt that it could be anything between 5 and 50%.
Plus, is geoengineering the easy way out to solving our climate problems?
Just run a hose 6 miles up into the sky. It's just like a little bit bigger than a garden hose. And you put one at the North Pole, one at the South Pole. And you turn on the spigot and up comes a spritz of sulfur dioxide.
How can architecture help the environment?
You wouldn't just get the accretion of carbon dioxide crystals. You would also get growth of the building walls. We might also get repair of fractures that were existing within the walls of buildings.
Why nappies have created a bit of a shitstorm.
Having had 4 children, I always use washable nappies, the same ones, soak them in water with vinegar and tea tree oil, wash them at 30 degrees with the rest of my washing using Bio-D washing powder, and then line dried them.
And how accurately could you depict science in drama?
The lazy portrayal of a scientist is the geek with the glasses who sort of stutters but actually comes up with a solution in the end, but you know we'll never get the girl. And I felt sorry on behalf of scientists.
And the perfect climax to this intro sequence, we simply couldn't ignore this story. The headline reads, Female Viagra. And no, we're not going to play a clip from When Harry Met Sally. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample is back with us in the pod after just disappearing without so much of a goodbye. Astronomy writer Stuart Clarke is also here. Now, who is Stuart? Well, there's a very handy section on his website called Just That. That's stuartclarke.com, no E. It says he's one of the UK's most widely read astronomy journalists. He has a PhD in astrophysics. He was former editor of Astronomy Now magazine. Currently, he spends most of his time writing books and working for the European Space Agency, New Scientist, and BBC Sky at Night. He's also a fellow of the Royal Astronomical Society and a former vice chair of the Association of British Science Writers. Stuart, welcome to the pod.
Hi, Alec. Thanks for inviting me along.
Now, last time you were here, we were talking about your astronomical hero, Richard Carrington, who was alive several hundred years ago. We're going to talk about something much more current this time around, climate change. This is not something perhaps that astronomers are normally talking about, but some climate change skeptics believe that the sun is one of the major things causing climate change on Earth. So it's not just greenhouse gas emissions from human beings that are causing the temperatures to rise. It's the fact that the sun changes in activity over time. Stuart, can you just take us through this idea, first of all?
The first thing to say is that nobody seriously believes that the sun is solely responsible for modern climate change. Some people believe, however, that there is some confusion in the way we translate greenhouse gases into temperatures, and that perhaps some of this confusion can be alleviated if we understand some of the natural effects that the sun might be having as well. Now, there's a number of different ways that that can happen, all of them linked to the magnetic activity on the sun. So there's the very famous idea that the magnetic field of the sun can shield the Earth from particles coming from deep space, and these so-called cosmic rays, when they hit the Earth in large numbers, they can perhaps modulate the way that clouds form. And if we have low-level clouds forming in this way, then that reflects sunlight and cools the Earth.
So this is very different from the idea that some skeptics of global warming might have, which is that actually just because the sun's there and its activity seems to be increasing and decreasing over a set period, that this just means more radiation reaches the Earth and therefore temperatures are rising because of that. So what you're describing is something that's actually a bit more sort of, there's a bit more evidence for what you're suggesting.
Yeah, so unfortunately it's absolutely not as simple as the sun just varying its brightness. We can clearly say that that's not the cause, and in fact those sorts of brightness changes are taken into account in all the climate change models, so we've got that in there. It's other effects, more invisible effects to do with particles or perhaps ultraviolet radiation and how that affects the chemistry in the stratosphere, which produces heat, which changes weather patterns down in the lower layers.
So what's the sort of bonus of contention along this? Do we just not know the level of this is happening at, given the various sort of cycles that the sun goes through?
That's right. We don't know the level at which this can affect us on the Earth, and in certain cases as well, we don't yet know the chain of events, the actual physics of what's taking place here. And until we can understand that, all we have to go on are some correlations, some of which are better than others. So we see a bit of change of activity on the sun, and we think we see some change in climate on the Earth. And so we have to try and find if that's just a coincidence or whether there is an actual chain of cause and effect there.
But what's the potential change that this could be having? I mean, will it change what we do in terms of address targets for greenhouse gas reductions, emissions, and what we think we can stabilize at in terms of temperature for the next century?
Well, first of all, I think that it shouldn't affect in any way what we do in trying to limit greenhouse gas production. Until the debate this week, I would have said that at most the sun could be contributing about a third of modern warming, and that's enough that we can sort of remove the confusion from the climate models. However, this week I learnt that it could be anything between 5% and 50%.
That's a huge factor to drop into things like negotiations at Copenhagen, for example, where they're trying to say, well, we need to reduce emissions by X amount because we think the models are going to show that we're onto 6 degrees warming by the end of the century, or 4 degrees or whatever. It just goes to show that the climate models seem completely to change every few years, depending on factors quite outside our control. I mean, are astronomers really getting into this more and more and more? I mean, how are we going to test this stuff out?
Yes, astronomers are becoming more interested in this. They're talking to the climate change community more. And beautifully, there is a quirk of nature that is happening at the moment that actually allows us to make a definitive test of all of the solar contribution. And that is that the solar activity is dropping like a stone at the moment. So whereas it's been on the rise for most of the 20th century, now suddenly, for reasons that we don't quite understand, this solar magnetic activity has reduced drastically.
This is outside the sort of normal cycle of solar activity that goes up and down every, is it, decade or so?
Yeah, so about every 11 years the sun moves through this cycle of activity from high to low to high again. And this year, in fact, we have had a profound low in the solar activity, and although we expect that activity to turn upwards again in the next few years, nobody now expects it to go up by very much. We're back now to a level of solar activity that was last seen in the 1920s.
So what does that mean in terms of experiments? What can we do to verify some of this stuff that you're talking about?
What it means is that the solar contribution to climate is actually being pretty much taken away, almost completely, in fact. So we now need to look and watch for what the temperature of the Earth does and the climate of the Earth does, and if there's any trend downwards or anything like that, we can actually use that to say this is the solar contribution, and now, finally and at last, we can be absolutely rock-solid certain of what is the man-made contribution.
Ian?
Stuart, I just wondered if you could say a bit more about the mechanisms that might be playing a role, because if you're suggesting that the sun can be contributing to some extent to warming, that suggests that it's been doing something different sort of since the Industrial Revolution, essentially.
So by this peculiar quirk of solar activity, it's been on the rise for most of the 20th century as well. And some of the mechanisms are, say, ultraviolet radiation. The solar activity drives these huge flares on the sun, and the amount of ultraviolet radiation that can be released varies by a factor of about 100, in fact. And that ultraviolet radiation drives chemistry in the upper atmosphere to do with ozone. And as the climate models have started to include this stratospheric chemistry, so they've been getting better agreements with the temperature of the Earth.
Now, Stuart, you're going to be discussing some of this stuff on your Twitter account. So people can just come and ask you questions. How's that going to work? How do they find you first?
They can find me if they go onto Twitter and look for at Dr. Stu Clark.
Then they can post questions? Or
they can post questions if they use the hashtag AskDrStu.
But you're going to be doing a series of these sort of question and answer sessions. What else are you talking about?
So we're going to talk about all those great questions that we have, such as what is dark matter and the chances that we can detect that in the near future. We'll be doing some historical ones as well. I have this huge interest in the astronomers of the past. So we might talk about Galileo, or we might talk about this German astronomer, Johannes Kepler, who doesn't seem to be remembered very much. And yet, really, he's an absolute genius, the first person to take a natural phenomenon and put it into mathematics. So he's three laws of planetary motion, absolutely epochal event in human history.
Let me ask one thing about dark matter. What's the latest on this at the moment? Have we found it? Are we near to finding it? Does it exist? Have we decided that it doesn't exist? Because that's what happens. Seems to happen every 6 months.
As of today, the dark matter is not looking as certain as it perhaps once was.
Hooray!
The reason for that is some work that was done recently about trying to look at the distribution of dark matter in galaxies. And the dark matter has always said that it just produces gravity, so it should clump together right towards the center of the galaxy. And yet, for somehow, different galaxies all seem to have this uniform distribution of dark matter in their centers, which just shouldn't happen, actually. So there are two ways out of this. Either the dark matter is exerting a force on itself, and so dark matter is essentially much weirder than we ever thought it was, or it's just wrong. And instead, what we need to do is look again at our understanding of gravity and see if there's a flaw there in that force.
Okay, well, thanks, Stuart, for that. To find out more about Stuart's Twitter chats, you can go to stuartclark.com. You can also find out details about his latest book, Galaxy, which has some of the most beautiful pictures of the universe ever produced.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Now, a new series on the BBC starts this week called Paradox. It appears to be a cross between Minority Report, Flash Forward, and the Ticking Clock of 24. It centres on some images transmitted back from space, which appear to show fragments of an event that hasn't yet happened. It ponders, if you could change the future, should you? The writer of the programme, Lizzie Mickery, joined us in the studio to look at the science. She says all of it is theoretically possible.
We change the future. Then what?
It is general relativity. It is looking at parallel universes. It is how that could possibly happen. If these images were coming, what kind of experiments would you set up in order to try and ascertain where they're coming from? And also, we have a magnetic electronic storm, which runs through the first episode and is dying out in the second episode, and actually has something to do with what is occurring. So all of that we've looked at very closely. Now, I'm not saying there will be other physicists out there listening to this going, bunkum. But the theory is there. If certain elements happened, then this could happen.
As far as the paperwork is concerned, this job doesn't exist.
The images don't make any sense.
It's your perception of them that's failing to make sense.
I'll put the pieces together. I'm not breaking the law.
With any drama, the same as any film, really, how closely do you stick with the science? It's not a documentary, it's fiction.
Well, of course, you're using the science to drive the drama in the story. Absolutely. And I'm not there to convert people to become physicists or teach them, you know, about the solar system or whatever. It is a drama. And if we stick as closely to the rules as we can, obviously in an exciting, dramatic way and not in a sort of schoolroom way, but in an exciting, dramatic way, I think it actually feeds the drama because you really do think, oh, yes, this might happen to me.
He's called Christian King. Dr. Christian King, space scientist, Prometheus Innovation.
Space scientist? He wants to see a detective.
In less than 6 hours, something cataclysmic is going to happen.
Now, our lead character is a physicist. And what is interesting about Christian, of course, is that if you put a scientist together with the police, they have totally different ways of doing things. Evidence means something completely different to him. Police are always looking for answers. But scientists, there are no answers, there are only more questions. And every time you get an answer, you know, if you do find the Higgs boson, Some people are actively hoping that you don't, that you find something else. And out of that comes something else.
Paradox starts on Tuesday 24th of November at 9 o'clock on BBC One. It'll also be available on iPlayer. For more info, go to bbc.co.uk/paradox. Let's take a look now at some of the other science stories around this week.
News Jack.
NASA has struck water on the moon. The LCROSS probe that was deliberately crashed into the southern polar region last month has discovered at least 25 gallons of water. Scientists hope future study of the probe's findings could shed light on the evolution of the solar system, in the same way as an ice core sample taken from deep beneath the Earth's surface reveals data on ancient geological events.
Global temperatures could rise by 6 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. As CO2 emissions increase, the Earth's natural ability to absorb the gas declines. The study by the University of East Anglia with the British Antarctic Survey is the most comprehensive to date and is expected to give greater urgency to diplomatic manoeuvring before Copenhagen.
Woolly mammoths and other giant Ice Age mammals faced extinction 2,000 years before deadly spear tips were invented. Some thought humans arrived and decimated the population in a few hundred years, but researchers at the University of Wisconsin say that's not consistent with what they've found. Archaeological evidence shows that humans developed advanced spearheads around 13,000 years ago. The Clovis people of North America crafted spear tips with deep grooves that made wounds bleed freely. And with these, hunters did not have to kill their prey on the spot, but could wait for the beasts to bleed to death.
Ever since Viagra arrived a decade ago and became a global blockbuster worth billions, an equivalent that works wonders for women has been the holy grail for drug companies. Now, doctors announce the search might finally be over. The drug, flibanserin, which was originally developed as an antidepressant, is claimed to give more satisfying sexual encounters and a higher libido.
I've got to pick up on the female Viagra question with you because you wrote this story. And just for background for listeners, Ian is the man who discovered the patent on the female orgasm machine, number one. Then he wrote about the fMRI scans of women's G-spots. And now female Viagra, you are like female orgasm king.
Thank you.
Tell us about this research.
I don't know how to follow that.
Sorry. You're a professional.
This was a drug developed by a German drug company that was originally for anti-depression, but early on they realized that it wasn't particularly effective as an antidepressant. But they did find some other interesting side effects, which then became the subject of the major clinical trials. And we've heard about the phase 3 clinical trials last week. The drug's called flibanserin. It's a serotonin agonist, which basically means it will bind to some of the serotonin, like the feel-good sort of brain transmitter sort of molecules. It'll bind to some serotonin receptors and block others. So it does something fairly delicate in the brain. But anyway, it was trialed on women who were diagnosed with these are fairly vague definitions, but diagnosed with a condition that essentially means you have a very low libido. And then throughout the 6-month trial, you look at how often they're having what they would describe as good sex, basically. And the drug won out against placebo. It was a blind trial. So that's, you know, it seems to be a decent study. But there are all sorts of questions that you really need to ask about, you know, the value of a pill like this and whether it's sensible to call it a female Viagra.
So yes, just on that point, is this a genuine condition or is it something, one of those things that Ben Goldacre would call the medicalization of normal life?
Yeah, I mean, it's the tricky thing with this is it's an enormous overlap. There obviously are some women who may be upset at their low libido, but what a drug company will typically do is try and expand its patient pool as much as possible so it can obviously shift more drugs onto as many people. I mean, if you look at Pfizer, they suggest enormous numbers of men could potentially benefit from Viagra. And I'm sure they potentially could, but do they need it? You know, that's another question. And this always comes up with drug companies when, you know, they obviously don't want to say, look, we know our market is 0.1% of the over 40-year-old women. They will try and sell it to as many as possible. So you have the idea about, you know, how which women really want this drug and need this drug. But the other issue is, can you really solve a problem such as low libido by chucking a pill at it? I mean, with men, it's something slightly
different.
Seems
to have worked with men, yeah.
But with Viagra, we're talking about a physiological thing for erectile dysfunction. I mean, if you can't get it up, then a pill can help you get it up, right? With a woman, it's you're saying you have to try and what you're trying to do is say this pill will make you want to have sex. And the reason you probably don't want to have sex could be a whole range of things. You could be in a terrible relationship. Your boyfriend might be rubbish in bed. You might be stressed out. You've got your mind on other things. You might just not fancy it for a few months. I mean, you know, your answer probably won't be in a pill. It might help some women some of the time, though.
Let's move from that to straight to the moon. Last week, L-Cross, the thing that Ian, you blogged as it crashed into the moon a few months, about a month ago, NASA announced that they'd found water on the moon with a huge sort of press conference and lots of excitement and sort of emails and Twitters all around the world going around saying, oh, NASA's discovered water on the moon. Stuart, I thought we'd discovered water on the moon 3 months ago. What happened? Was that not real water?
It was real water. It was like a film on these rocks, the surface rocks. And the small print of that discovery was that it was minuscule quantities.
That was Chandrayaan 1. That was the Indian scientists.
That's right. And it's, that started this kind of roller coaster about water on the moon, when in fact what they had discovered, the quantities of water that Chandrayaan 1 had discovered, made the moon drier than the Sahara Desert.
They sent the probe and the following probe with a camera on it down, you know, an incredibly deep crater in one of the lunar poles. You never get any sunlight down there. It's the last place on the moon you would consider putting a lunar base. So the fact that there may be frozen water down there is kind of by the by, because you might send a robot down there. You probably won't see it again. It's interesting, I suppose, but how much more interesting it is than the Indian data, I don't think very much, personally.
So, Stuart, why did they make such a big thing about this? I mean, they're not going to probably build a base down there. There's not really that much water, and it's a nice result. But why all the hoo-ha, do you think?
Okay, so NASA's under extreme pressure at the moment. The budgetary pressure on NASA, they're facing a huge deficit. The Augustine Committee report said that they simply don't have the money to achieve their ambitions in manned space exploration. So in that sense, any piece of news that can be that can be used to suggest, oh, it might be easier than we once thought it was, I think is getting hyped.
So the announcement was more for the American political class than for the rest of the world. It's just that we all get very excited whenever NASA says anything.
Yeah, I think essentially that's about right.
Okay, well, for everything you want to know about this stuff, go to guardian.co.uk/science or /environment. Last week's podcast on eco-myths appears to have generated, well, let's call it a bit of interest, on the blogs. Particularly, it surrounded the issue of nappies, or diapers as they say in other parts of the world. In fact, you could say it caused a bit of a shitstorm, if you excuse the pun. In response, here's Duncan Clark again from our environment website. He wrote about environmentally friendly nappies for the Rough Guide to Green Living.
I had no idea that of all the stories we touched on, that the nappy one would be the one that everyone picks up on. I would have thought that the possibility that our entire agenda around reducing electricity emissions at home not having necessarily any direct impact might be more significant. But people seem concerned about nappies, so I'll quickly touch on those again. A lot of people were asking, was I quoting the Environment Agency study from a few years ago? I was indeed. Someone very kindly pointed to a newer study, which had slightly different conclusions in that it said if you use best practice in your use of reusable nappies, then you will have a reduction in carbon emissions of around 40%. This actually doesn't really fly in the face of what we said on the podcast, which I believe was in a typical usage situation, the carbon footprint of reusable nappies could be higher, but that this wasn't true if you went some way to using them in a green manner. In fact, reading from the book that I was writing about, I quote
The Women's Environmental Network, long-standing proponent of washable nappies, point out that the study made various assumptions that wouldn't apply to most green-minded people. They show that if you have an energy-efficient washing machine, a 60-degree wash cycle, limit yourself to 24 nappies, and don't tumble dry or iron them, then the washable option ends up producing a quarter less CO2 than disposables. So then really the debate comes down to what is typical usage. And judging from some of our commenters, it seems that they don't necessarily represent the majority. Long Grig has added on our comments, having had 4 children, I always use washable nappies, the same ones, soak them in water with vinegar and tea tree oil, wash them at 30 degrees with the rest of my washing using Bio-D washing powder, and then line dried them. Well, very good for Long Grig to have taken so many green steps, and I'm sure that that is about as green as you can get, but I'm afraid that probably isn't a typical user. But perhaps the most extreme was Arnson's response to someone saying, if you really care about the environment, don't have babies. He's added the great lines, and if you really, really care about the environment, kill yourself. And if you really, really, really care about the environment, kill other people. Well, I think we better leave it with that. And a brief disclaimer that The Guardian can't endorse the killing of people on environmental grounds.
If you want to have your say, either join our Facebook group and post a comment on the wall, or leave a thought on the blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
You may have heard about a book a while back called Freakonomics. This book was co-written by Stephen Levitt, the University of Chicago's self-styled rogue economist. He basically takes unusual issues, removes morality from them, and applies pure economic theory. Well, Levitt's just published his follow-up, Super Freakonomics, which looks at subjects like why are prostitutes so patriotic, and why should suicide bombers make sure they purchase life insurance. But he's received some fierce criticism from the Green Lobby over one section of his book on climate change, where he advocates the use of geoengineering techniques to solve all of our problems quickly and easily. Stephen's been in talking to The Guardian.
A lot of people have talked about what I say in the book and what I don't say. Let me start by saying what we actually do say in the book. We start with the absolute same fundamental scientific facts, which are that the Earth has gotten warmer. And then instead of jumping to the conclusion that you need to cut carbon to deal with it, we actually lay out some of the facts about the problems with the carbon mitigation strategy, which are, number one, it's incredibly expensive. The estimates that people come up with are, you know, trillions of dollars, 1 to 2% of GDP to the end of time. It could cost £15,000 per household to redo your house to make a greenhouse to be energy efficient to meet this sort of carbon mitigation. That's expensive. It's a lot of real money. The second problem is that carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere for a long time. Roughly 100 years is a half-life. So anything we do today to reduce carbon will only begin to pay the real benefits 50 to 100 years from now. So even if we were to cut carbon emissions by 25% or something right quite radical, the Earth would continue to warm. The third problem is that I don't feel the direct benefit of my own actions to reduce carbon. It doesn't matter whether I reduce carbon or not. What doesn't even matter if the UK reduces carbon or not. What matters is, does China, India, the United States? I mean, it's what is called the collective action problem. And if there's anything that economists have learned over the course of humankind, it's that you cannot rely on 7 billion people's good natures and common spirit to all come together and say, let's just all sacrifice to try to solve this world problem. I just think it's a pipe dream. I think it is a fiction and a unrealistic hope to think that carbon dioxide mitigation will be the solution to this problem in the short run. We instead say, if you just had an emergency and you had to cool the Earth as quickly and as efficiently as possible, what would you want to do? Okay, and that question we try to answer, and that's really a very simple question. It's a kind of a technological question, and there are scientists out there, and there are these what are called geoengineering solutions. Some sound like science fiction. Some sound environmentally nice.
And one of the solutions that you hit upon is a hose.
Yeah, so they're one of the more science fiction-y stories, but it is actually, the engineering's worked out, is you would just run a hose 6 miles up into the sky. It's just like a little bit bigger than a garden hose, and you put one at the North Pole, one at the South Pole, and you turn on the spigot, and up comes a spritz of sulfur dioxide, which they put into the stratosphere, and it would be about 1/200th of the overall world's generation of sulfur dioxide would be needed, because you get it high enough in the stratosphere, it stays up there for a very long time, doesn't come down as acid rain. And they believe, based on volcanic evidence, because volcanoes shoot sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere as well, that we can cool the Earth to absolutely whatever temperature we want doing this. Now, of course, it's not a solution to the root cause. It's not going to get rid of the carbon. It could have unintended consequences and risks associated with it. But if the question is, how do we cool the Earth if we really need it cool? Or how do we buy ourselves 50 years while technology catches up and we figure out some clever way to pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere much more cheaply than we can do it now? It doesn't seem to me like a crazy kind of insurance policy to have. I mean, we have dental insurance. Why not have planetary insurance?
Stephen Levitt there talking to The Guardian's Aditya Chakraborty. Superfreakonomics is out now, and you can hear more of that interview with Stephen in our business podcast at guardian.co.uk/thebusiness.
Science Weekly.
How do we make buildings more sustainable? Most of today's structures are made using Victorian techniques. But what about using things that work with nature? Well, scientists have been looking at something called metabolic materials to create living buildings.
I'm Rachel Armstrong. I'm a TED Fellow. And I'm a teaching fellow at the Bartlett School of Architecture. My research really is about how we can think about buildings differently, and how they can actually be part of the ecosystem and not separate from it, be less like machines and more like biological organisms. So I was looking at the properties of physics and chemistry and those languages that exist within living systems whereby a structure stays in contact with the environment is a metabolism. So essentially a metabolism is a set of chemical reactions that cause the conversion of one group of substances into another group, either with the absorption or the production of energy. And the kinds of things that a metabolic material will allow us to do will be to, for example, take advantage of the entire surface area of our buildings and use this as a dynamic membrane, if you like, where we can design metabolisms and design interactions that we want to see take place between our buildings and the natural world or the climate. And of course, the big one that we'd all like to be able to address would be carbon capture. Is it possible for us to use the surface of the built environment to capture carbon? And we've been able to produce a couple of systems now whereby we can use these chemical computers in order to convert dissolved carbon dioxide into a material form. And we're at proof of concept stage, so we can think about the other properties that might exist within these materials if we were able to generate layers on the outside of our buildings that were able to fix carbon dioxide. So you wouldn't just get the accretion of or mineralization of these of carbon dioxide crystals. You would also get growth of the building walls, which would, of course, increase their thermal insulation qualities. We might also get repair of fractures that were existing within the walls of buildings.
If you want to hear more about this, Rachel is giving a lunch hour lecture at UCL called Living Buildings on the 26th of November. Go to ucl.ac.uk for more information.
Hi, this is Katie Tunstall and you're listening to Science Weekly on guardian.co.uk.
Our thanks to astronomy journalist Stuart Clark and Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Next week, we've got philosopher A.C. Grayling back in the pod. To finish this week's podcast, though, more music. A gem we found as part of the heavy research that goes into this programme. It's the winner of DiscoverMagazine.com's Evolution in 2 Minutes or Less video competition. It's called Evolution the Song by teacher Scott Hatfield and student Brianna Christofferson from Bullard High School in Fresno, California. I know what I think of it, but you make of it what you will.
So you say there's a time limit. You must explain in just 2 minutes why there are so many different things alive. But I can summarize in just 5 seconds.
Mutation, translation, expression, occasion, genetic variation, population selection.
We're all members of populations. We carry patterns of information. We try to pass them on to the next generation. In new combinations. Genetic variation. The populations tend to thrive until they shoot past the food supply. No surprise, it's a struggle to survive. We can now ask why. Some live and some die.
Mutation, translation, expression, occasion, genetic variation, population selection.
Evolution. Changes occur.
Evolution.
It'll change the world.
Evolution.
The changes go on and on.
Just gene and passing. it on to your offspring, they'll have the same advantage too. And they in turn have more success at reproducing. We witness the fitness that's produced when nature gets to choose. Let's give Darwin his due. Over time, the population, if left in isolation, is free to go its own way too. Speciation, something new, and all the beauty and diversity of the natural world.
Selection,
evolution, changes occur.
Evolution,
it'll change.